Welcome to the Onyx Podcast. I am this week's host, Dixie Cochran, here as always with Eddie Webb.
Hello.
And Matthew Dawkins.
Hello.
You didn't do like a weird voice this week, Matthew. I don't know who you are.
Maybe that is a weird voice. Maybe my real voice sounds more like this. And you just never knew, did you? Because you never guessed. You always just assumed there's that silver spoon in his mouth, Matthew Dawkins. With his plum in his throat.
That's exactly how I think inside my head about you, definitely.
There's yeah, that the plum part, spoon, definitely.
Plum.
There is always a plum lodged in my throat.
All right, now we've gotten off to our usual awesome, ridiculous start. I want to say that this week we are going to be interviewing Jacqueline Brick. So, yeah. For those of you who don't know Jax, we'll of course get to know her better in the interview. It's going to be a one-on-one with me and her, partially because she lives about 15 minutes away from me, so it was easy. Partially because it was a nighttime recording, so not everybody's available. She does a lot of work both with the LARP community, the tabletop community, and also specifically with safety and trauma rules, and kind of how to make your game enjoyable for everybody at the table. And you know, how to both make sure your players are comfortable and how to express if you're not comfortable, which I think is a really important thing for games, especially horror games, but really any game. Right. I think it's important to know that you can get up and walk away from a table. It's important to know that your GM or storyteller or what have you has your back if you're feeling uncomfortable. So yeah, that's a conversation that we're going to have. Talk about her work probably not only on Onyx Path properties, but also for the safety rule she did for White Wolf. She's done a lot of work on Cult Divinity Lost, which is a really heavy game. So yeah, is anything that y'all want to hear her talk about specifically or that you're interested in?
I know she's done a lot of stuff in the LARP community, so I'm curious what her thoughts are in terms of where LARP's at and how that's going to go.
Right.
And likewise, I worked with her on Cult, so it will be interesting to hear her thoughts with me not being in the room.
Yeah, totally. I did a very minimal amount of work on one of the Cult books, almost as like a subcontractor for her, just because she got a little overloaded one time. But that's the only experience I've had with Cult so far, so I'm interested to hear a little bit more about it. I know she's working on, I think, like a safety book for them, like a specific, like, how to use this game responsibly, or how to play it to the best of your advantage, essentially.
Actually, hang on a second. So that means that Cult is another product all three of us have worked on together?
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't hire Dixie for my book. Sorry, Dixie, but we've not got to editing yet.
Oh, so you still could hire me then.
I could. We'll see.
Is that the only outside Onyx Path property we've all worked on together?
I think so.
Ooh, that's a good question, isn't it? I think, yeah.
I mean,
I think it probably is.
Star Wars, L5R, Call of Cthulhu.
I've not worked on Call of Cthulhu, I've not worked on any of the Fantasy Flight stuff, so.
Okay.
I've worked for Cthulhu. I still do in a lot of ways.
You are making a game called They Came From Beneath the Sea.
So. These people won't drown themselves.
Speaking of which, before we go into the intro, I had this joke. Ian Watson, our great friend Ian Watson, has this a euphemism about sending people into the sea when he doesn't like them.
Right.
And Meredith posted that on Facebook, and I said, and I tagged, They Came From Beneath the Sea. I was very amused by that, but nobody else was. So.
I think that one of our freelancers, I'm not going to say who because I've forgotten, but one of our freelancers on the Exalted Slack, her tag, if you hover over her name, is throwing Neil into the sea, or at least it was for a while. So it could be Neil who's coming from beneath the sea in the future.
There we go. I'll have to remember that.
Which would be a whole thing.
Which would be appropriate if... And this is something that frustrates me down to the bone. It's when people misname They Came From Beneath the Sea as It Came From Beneath the Sea. But, you know, what? If we go for that, Neil can be It.
That's erasure of some sort, I'm sure.
Sea monster erasure. We won't stand for it.
Also, what if only one monster comes from beneath the sea? What if it's a giant kaiju monster and that's the only one?
Then it's gender neutral thing.
Then I would ask him or her or they what the kaiju is, and I wouldn't just assume that it's an it.
True. Any Anything can be a they. They is a singular pronoun, people. I will die on that hill.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And on that note, I will say that we do discuss some heavy topics in the interview. So let's, you know, just go into it knowing that, and knowing that you are free to turn things off if at any point it becomes something you don't want to listen to. I don't think it will be as mature or heavy of a topic as Phil Bricado's interview, but we do still go to a few places, and we're also both fairly political. So just fair warning. And with that, on to the interview with Jacqueline Brick. Welcome back to the Onyx Pathcast. I'm your host, Dixie Cochran, here with our guest this week, Jacqueline Brick.
Hello.
Hi, Jax.
Hi.
You will definitely hear me call her Jax. That's the nickname a lot of us refer to her by. Mm-hmm. You've probably seen her name in a ton of our books. What all have you worked on?
Well, some of them aren't out yet, so you might not have seen my
well,
name.
I've seen your name in a ton of books because I edit them. So
currently I've worked on, the lines I've worked on are Exalted, Vampire the Requiem, Changeling the Lost Second Edition, Demon the Descent. Mage the Ascension.
Yeah.
Mage the Ascension.
You did quite a bit of work on that one.
Yeah, and I also did the safety rules for Vampire 5th Edition, as well as a whole bunch of non-White Wolf and Onyx Path properties.
Yeah, true. You work on Cults and...
Yep. Fading Suns.
Fading Suns.
Jason Pitts After the War, which is currently on Kickstarter.
That's cool. Yeah, this isn't like just about the Onyx Path. You can talk about any projects you need to. It's totally fine. You also publish a lot of your own games, a lot of LARPs.
I do, yes. You can find me on DriveThruRPG under Jacqueline Brick. When you look at it, you might think Burke for some reason, even though the R is totally before the Y in my name.
I have never looked at your name and thought that, but
yeah,
I understand.
Yeah, no, it's Burke, Brike.
That's okay. I've definitely gotten the Cochran pronounced as Cochran several times,
oh, good.
And I'm like, it's a common name. Like,
yeah.
All right, cool. Well, yeah, so that's like a small sample of your work. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of what you're passionate about are like safety rules when it comes to both LARP and tabletop.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about your history with that, working with safety rules and trauma rules?
So, I actually started as, like, a hardcore stick jock LARPer and, like, really crunchy tabletopper.
Okay.
And so I wasn't really exposed to them until a couple years ago, and I just sort of fell in love with the whole idea of safety rules, because one of the major issues when you're telling stories with other people is some people's ideas of what fun is can clash with other people's, and it's just a good way to prevent friction at your table, and there's deeper stuff to it, but we can talk about that more.
We can get more into it. We've definitely, we touch on what fun is on the podcast so often.
Yep.
Because everybody's got their own idea of it. For some people, it's, you know, I want to play a character that just murders everything in sight with a gun. And for some people, it's I want to have a more, like, emotional experience or more of a cerebral experience. So.
It's actually really interesting because one of the things I've been talking with other LARP designers about is the difference between fun and enjoyment. Because there are some LARPs that are just, like, leave you wrecked and broken, and, like, you need to go curl up for a few hours to process the experience, and we're like, I want to say that was fun, but it wasn't fun. It was enjoyable, and I would do it again.
Yeah, I've only recently, as a lot of our listeners know, I've only recently kind of gotten into LARP, having kind of been turned off from it many, many years ago, and... Getting to observe Pandemonium at HLGCon was really interesting, because I don't think too many people who were doing that would say it was super fun.
Yeah.
It looked really heavy.
Which one was Pandemonium?
That was the one where, like, six different studios came together and made the factions.
Oh, okay.
And then they put them all at a Halloween party that they couldn't leave.
I was
the DJ, so I was kind of, like, an NPC in the game.
Okay.
But it was really, really interesting, because it was just all these different LARP
studios intense,
put together. Yeah. And yeah, it was very intense from what I heard about the unpacking afterward.
Yeah.
And I know that you do a lot of, you know, somewhat intense or emotional LARPs.
I do, yes.
Seems to be kind of your jam. In fact, isn't my jam one of the intense emotional LARPs you do?
It's one of the LARPs I've played, and my testimonial is definitely on the Kickstarter, which... My jam is also on Kickstarter, if you like the comic Phonomancer.
I'm not familiar.
I am not familiar either, but I'm sure some of your listeners are, because it's a very popular comic.
Okay.
Phonomancer and the Wicked and the Divine.
I do love Wicked and the Divine.
It's basically a game where you're playing Dionysus the whole game, where there's a DJ, and the Blessed DJ plays from a list of songs that the players send him at the beginning of the game. And when your song is on, you're the god of the dance floor. And that can either be super fun or have some serious repercussions. Sorry, we're just moving a cat. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, so one of my cats is the bad one, and we're actually recording at my house right now because Jax lives very close to me.
Mm-hmm.
So the bad cat has decided that he wants to be a part of this, which, yep. I mean, that's fine. He can be a part of this. It just means that he walks on tables sometimes.
Emotional safety animal. Also probably going to bite my face in a little bit.
Possibly. He does that. This is a whole thing. Anyway, so yeah, that sounds super cool. The whole being, you know, god of the dance floor for that moment, and it's especially like when you're playing. Really,
come here,
really, cat.
It's fine. It's cool. We got it.
So when you're playing do you like know when your song's gonna come
you
on,
have
or is it a
no
surprise?
No idea. It's a surprise.
So you could be like having like an intense moment with somebody, and then suddenly it comes on, or you could be like hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
That's super cool.
And if it comes on in the middle of an intense moment, that can be play in and of itself, because now you're in control of literally everything that's happening on the dance floor, including this person you are having this intense moment with.
Once again, enjoyable. Maybe not always fun,
but very enjoyable.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it. That's one that I've looked into maybe trying at some point. So that's super cool. So what other what other LARPs or games would you kind of consider emotional, if not fun? Whether it's your own work or other just games that you appreciate. I know you're a Bluebeard's Bride fan.
I love Bluebeard's Bride so much. Ben Lehman's Polaris, which uses poetry and key phrases to tell a tragic chivalrous story.
Okay.
About Ice Fae, essentially.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why I'm very gently touching the table. It's fine. Sorry, I talk with my hands a lot. I'm not Italian. Which is weird. It's just gesture a lot. God, what else? Cult can be emotional but not fun, which is actually why I'm going to be writing a full safety book for Cult.
Yeah, I can see that. That game's got a level of intensity that might need its own
safety book.
Shout out,
shout out to my developer who really hates it when I call it a safety book, because it's like, no, it's a book about how to elegantly play trauma in Cult, and I'm like, Peter, it's a safety book.
I mean, I think that most games, especially, you know, horror games or games that get personal or emotional, need some kind of safety rules.
Yeah.
Even in the most, what people would consider, like, family-friendly games, a lot of games now are at least introducing mechanics like the X card.
Right.
Which is super, super important. I don't know if we've talked about it before on the podcast. I think we have. But if you want to, like, refresh on what that is, it's, like, a basic safety mechanic.
So John Stavropoulos came up with a Google Doc, which you can easily find by searching X card Google Doc on Google.
Mm-hmm.
And it is Creative Commons and free to use. And essentially what it is if there is any content that is at any point out of game concerning or upsetting, you can just tap the X card and then it goes away, no questions asked. A lot of times, you know, people will check in and be like, hey, what about that was upsetting, so I can, you know, tone it down in the future. But
right.
Also a lot of times people will just be like, okay, fine, just backing off from that.
Well, yeah, because you don't want to accidentally, you know,
start it again, yeah.
Yeah, like, do it again, or if someone does have, you know, any kind of, you know, PTSD or emotional response to something, like, especially if you're trying to play a super fun, friendly D&D game.
Yep.
It's like, let's not do that right now. There's some games that lend themselves a little bit more to, you know, processing things emotionally, but even those, like, it can go too far. Anything
Absolutely.
Can be too far. And you don't know the backgrounds of all of your players, usually.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Like, even if it's your, you know, siblings, you still probably don't know every single thing that's happened to them.
Yeah.
So what are some other safety rules that you think are important for games?
So one of the things I find a lot of in games is just sort of this idea of, well, if I have something like the X card or cut and break, that's all I need.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't have to use any other safety rules. I can just throw them in there and tell people they can use them if they want. And while cut, break, and the X card are both very good and very common safety rules, a lot of them put the onus on the wronged party to speak up.
Right.
Which is not great. I mean, it's not enough to disqualify them from being safety rules. Like, I use cut in my games all the time, especially because a lot of my games take place in the dark or with loud noises.
Okay.
So, using cut is a really, really effective way to stop the action. Cut, by the way, is a command where you make an X above your head with your arms and say cut. And then all of the action stops, or break, which is, hey, this is getting a little too intense for me, I need you to back off for a little bit.
Right.
Some other safety rules, signals, whatever. I really liked the safety signals from Games to Gather, which is a group out in Portland. It's essentially a stoplight, and if you are kinky, you are probably familiar with this configuration. Not that anybody listening to the Pathcast would be kinky, that would be... That would be weird.
Nope, no comment.
No, definitely not. It's fine. It's cool. But essentially, it's you wear a strip of tape or a ribbon, or you have just these three colors out on your person or on the table somewhere, green, yellow, and red. And if you want to check in with someone, you tap your safety signal.
Okay.
And they either point to green, which is, you know, go, yellow, which is slow down, and red, which is stop. You can also sort of flutter in between two. So, like, if you want to up the intensity of a scene, you can sort of flutter between green and yellow.
Okay.
It's a really good, very simple way to just sort of get across the idea of, hey, I'm asking you where you're comfortable with, instead of you having to tell me without being prompted that you're uncomfortable.
Yeah, no, all the LARPs that I've been in so far just do the, like, okay check-in, but that sounds like it's a little bit even better than that.
I actually really prefer the okay check-in because it doesn't need the prop.
True. Right?
So the okay check-in is something I was introduced to through New World Magiskola. And you throw up an okay sign with your hand. And I don't know why I'm doing it, because you can't see it.
Because we're sitting in the same room.
Yeah.
It's the same reason that I keep catching myself nodding at you, and then realizing that I should say, like, right, or yes, or go on.
Yep.
Because we almost never do these interviews in the same room.
Nope, not at all.
Anyway.
So the idea then becomes you throw up an okay signal with your hands, and I don't care that Nazis are trying to co-opt the okay signal. It's ours. You can't have it.
Agreed.
And if somebody throws you an okay signal, you either give them thumbs up, you waggle your hand, or you give them a thumbs down. If you get thumbs up, great, continue play. If you get a hand waggle or thumbs down, stop, check in with that person, figure out what's up, figure out how you can both work together to fix it, if possible. And once that issue is resolved, continue play.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the mechanic as I've been introduced to it via Pandemonium and Hold the Folk at HLGCon. So that's the one I was aware of. It is nice to not have to rely on a prop. But
yeah.
Both are valid and both work.
No, I mean, really, saying that a safety signal is bad really doesn't convey what we mean, because all of these safety signals we've talked about so far are really good. Like, they are all useful and they all communicate something useful. The only way a safety mechanic could be bad is if it was didn't actually communicate anything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, totally.
Like, for example, Lines and Veils is a totally different safety mechanic from any of the ones we mentioned so far. It was pioneered by Ron Edwards in Sex and Sorcery.
Okay.
For what is sort of considered the first indie game, which is Sorcerer.
Okay.
I'm not sure what the truth of that is, but I know a lot of my indie gamer friends really liked Sorcerer and sort of found it as an inspiration to step away from more traditionally crunchy games.
Right.
But Lines and Veils doesn't actually do anything in the moment, necessarily. Before play, during Session Zero, which is something we'll talk about in a second.
Okay.
You establish lines, which are things that do not exist in the fiction, we will not talk about in the fiction, we will not even hint at in the fiction.
Right.
And veils, which are things that do exist in the fiction, but we're not going to go into in detail.
Okay.
And, like, when I say it doesn't do anything in play, that's not entirely correct. Like, people can establish new lines and veils during play, and can check in on others when veils are brought up, or, you know, catch themselves when they start approaching a line. but it's not the same. It's not at all the same sort of safety check-in that like the OK signal is, or cut and break are.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still really useful.
Yeah, I mean, that's talked about a lot in mostly a lot of our Chronicles books, but I think kind of across the board, mm-hmm. where they kind of say, like, set up beforehand with your players, like, what people are comfortable with, yeah. figure out. I mean, and that's part of the Session Zero thing you were talking yep. about, is not only, that can be character creation, which is fun, but part of that is kind of establishing what the game is going to be.
Yep.
I saw you do that a little bit when you ran Bluebeard's Bride for Jacob Burgess and his friends.
Yeah, that was great.
It was a lovely stream, you
guys. I'm really glad that we just took a point in time to mention Jacob during the stream, because I feel it's traditional now.
Yeah, Jacob's like the unofficial Pathcast mascot somehow. Yeah, I know. Not sure how that happened.
I am going to be having brunch with him at PAX.
Yeah.
Because he was on the panelists recently, which is a Loading Ready Run show.
Yeah.
And voted to get rid of brunch. So I have to remedy the sacrilege.
Oh my gosh, I saw that and didn't even think about how terrible that would be for
I know, right?
Someone like you, who is a Bloody Mary aficionado.
Just awful. Fucking terrible. Like, I was personally offended and I would not speak to him on Twitter for like an hour.
Yeah, wasn't it brunch or scarves?
It was brunch or scarves.
Who would pick scarves over brunch? Jacob, we're calling you out right now.
And we're calling you the hell out right now.
Yeah. You're going to be real red when you listen to this episode on
it's
Friday.
It's going to be great. We're thinking about you, Jacob.
Yeah. Yeah. We are. But not favorably. Either way, so... But you ran Bluebeard's Bride for, notably, a group of all men.
Yep.
Which I thought was really fascinating and really cool because, I mean, if you're going to explain a little bit about Bluebeard's Bride and why that's interesting.
Yeah, so Bluebeard's Bride is a game that was developed by... Oh my god, let me see if I... Magpie Games. I'm just trying to remember the name because it was Strix Beltron, it was Sarah Richardson, mm-hmm. and Marissa Kelly. Because I'm like, I wanted to say Mariska Hargitay, which, Marissa, if you're listening to this, you can take that as a compliment. It's fine. Although I would totally play a game of Bluebeard's Bride as run by Mariska Hargitay.
I think I would, too.
Dun, dun. Anyway, but it is notably a game about patriarchal violence. The whole game is essentially a giant exploration of trauma,
mm-hmm.
right? It is an exploration of generational, domestic, very femme-coded trauma.
Right.
And I've never run this game for all men before.
Mm-hmm.
Hashtag not all men. But,
the only acceptable reason to use that.
Yeah,
hashtag.
I know, right? It was me, Ryan, Jacob, Akash... Was there anyone else, or was it just those three?
I honestly can't remember.
I don't
even
remember.
Picture it, and I'm trying to remember there were three or four other boxes, and I'm like,
I feel so bad. But anyway, they were amazing.
Right.
They got super into it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you do before the session is you make it very, very clear, hey, this is a game about people getting hurt, mm-hmm. and you basically being powerless to stop it.
Right.
And the people being hurt are you.
Mm-hmm.
As well as, you know, everybody else who gets hurt. But I think I very jokingly made reference to the couch. So in the Bluebeard's Bride has a supplement called the Book of Rooms, which is just a bunch of sample rooms.
Right.
And there was a couch in the tea room, which molests you if you lay down on it. While also telling you that you're not good enough, like the last woman who owned this couch.
Wow.
Yeah, it's rough. Yeah,
that's heavy. Like, I'm sitting here just going, like, I don't like that in my brain.
The couch is actually one of my favorite monsters in Bluebeard's Bride, mm-hmm. just because it's so ridiculous.
Yeah, but also very monstrous.
Yeah. But one of the things we established beforehand is, you know, hey, what are some things that are absolutely off limits? Because there is a lot of sexual violence in this game.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, okay, how heavy do you want me to go on that? By the way, when I say there's a lot of sexual violence in this game, I don't mean to turn anybody off to it. There is also a lot of other terrible things you can play with in Bluebeard's Bride. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, it's a game about being a woman who's expected to submit to this violent, horrible man. And even though the game isn't actually about him, his house is attacking you and trying to shape you into this perfect, unattainable woman. And it's another good example of, like we were talking about earlier, games that are enjoyable but not necessarily fun.
Right.
And it's creepy and wonderful, and I absolutely recommend you pick it up. Did the cat just turn on the sink?
No, it's fine. Don't worry about it.
Okay, cool. Sorry. There was just a random water noise while we were talking about Bluebeard's Bride, and I was like, Jesus fucking Christ!
All right. So, I'll full disclosure, because this is apparently the full disclosure interview, because I want to be fun. This doesn't usually get picked up in the audio on the podcast. I've checked several times.
Okay.
But just around the corner is an automatic cat box that washes the pellets and everything.
That's hilarious.
So when one of the cats uses it runs its whole cycle. So that's a thing that so far, like, I'll hear it sometimes when I'm recording and be like, oh no, and then it's never been picked up in the audio and nobody said they could hear it. So, but since Jax is here in my house,
Jax had a slight flip out.
She thought that one of the cats was running the water, which honestly,
or like, your house is gonna start eating me because we were just talking about Bluebeard's Bride. Like, yes, it's a room where you go into, you know, the bathroom and you step into the bath and then the water rises and no matter how much you struggle to get to the top, you can't get to the top of the water and it's holding you down and telling you you need to be cleansed.
Yeah, that's just my house, apparently.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay,
no,
cool.
No.
So should I take a token of faithfulness or a token of disloyalty? Sorry, this isn't my
fight,
but...
it's okay, we're having a good time,
yeah.
Like I said.
Anyway.
I prefer a conversational, fun interview, even if we're going on weird tangents about cat bands.
The point was that we sort of were like, okay, so no sexual abuse of children. And I was like, you know what, that's fine. That is not something that is necessary for Bluebeard's Bride. However, one of them did mention that there was a younger boy in the village who had a crush on them mm-hmm. before they got married to Bluebeard. And they went downstairs to a disused study that had this giant bear in it, this giant stuffed bear with strange eyes.
Yep.
And as I'm describing the bear, Jacob just gets this horrified look on his face and goes, no, no. Ryan's like, what's up? He's in the bear. He's in the bear. If you cut open the bear, he's in the bear. And he was right.
Yeah, I remember that moment.
Yeah, because one of the things you do with Bluebeard's Bride is it's explicitly stated in the beginning, and it's something you're supposed to tell your players. Not specifically, but sort of give them the idea that anything they say in character creation will be used to horrify them later.
Right. Aside from the hard nose.
Yeah.
But yeah. Like, while you're making your actual character, those things are probably going to come back to haunt you.
Yep, because each person describes how part of the bride's body looks, because you're all playing the same bride mm-hmm. character. And each part of the body describes, I believe, either the bride's insecurities or how people feel about the bride.
Mm-hmm.
But... I'm sorry, I'm umming a lot.
That's okay, we all do it.
One of the games I ran at Gen Con, because I ran Bluebeard's Bride like 3 or 4 times at Gen Con, which, oof, that was a lot of Bluebeard's Bride in a weekend.
Yeah. Also, it's hard to imagine running it in a space as, like, crowded and kind of chaotic as Gen Con, because it's such a heavy game.
Yeah, so we actually, I was supposed to run it 3 times, and the 3rd time got canceled because only 2 people showed up. But for my second group, I actually took them to a little corner that was right outside of the room
mm-hmm.
on the second floor. So we had, like, this little alcove that was a little shadowy and a little echoey and was much less loud.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people was like, hey, I think it was the Animus, maybe, who has the question, what does the bride's body look like?
Right.
Or how tall is the bride? Something like that. I'd need to look at the game again. But they describe the bride as tall for a woman. So something I kept describing in the game is, well, this bed is too small for you, or your shoulders brush the door frames as you go through. I'm just making it feel very claustrophobic
mm-hmm.
for the bride, and how everything seemed to be a little too small for her because she was so tall.
Right.
And I realize this is supposed to be an episode on safety mechanics, but I'm getting to it. It's sort of this idea that you can use safety mechanics in conjunction with things like specifically targeting your players to create a much richer experience.
Right.
And when I say targeting, that sounds adversarial, and I really, really hate games that are like, the GM and the players are at odds, and that's not true.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think most people will understand what you mean when you say that. You are trying to evoke something specific for those players,
yep.
but you're doing it in service of the players.
Yep.
You're not trying to do it to make them upset or to make them angry, unless that's the actual mood that they are going for, that you've all agreed on.
Even then, you're trying to just make the characters angry.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I mean, if it's something like Hackmaster, where you're actually on an equal playing field and deliberately trying to, you know, beat the players, that's fine, mm-hmm. whatever. But in a game where you essentially have an omnipotence versus people with a limited skill sheet...
Yeah.
Yeah, no. That should not be adversarial.
Yeah, I've definitely played a couple of games of probably just D&D and Vampire and stuff where the GM or storyteller was obviously trying to kill us.
Yeah.
And it's like, that shouldn't be your entire goal. Like, no. We are trying to play this game. Or, you know, trying to piss somebody off because that was that person being a jerk.
Yep.
But I don't play with those people anymore because I'm an adult.
Hooray!
Yay!
One of the things I think gets misinterpreted a lot, especially when GMs say it, is I like seeing my players cry. Which, on the one hand, as somebody who really, really enjoys running heavy, dark games,
mm-hmm.
I like it when my players are emotionally involved with the material.
Right.
And I love it when, you know, people just lose themselves to the game, provided there is a safety net.
Well, yeah, also, there's multiple kinds of crying. There's the, you know, crying because something has touched you emotionally in a cathartic way, even if not a, once again, fun way.
Yeah.
And then there's crying because you are actively upset or frustrated.
Yeah.
And that's the kind that you don't want, generally.
Exactly. But a lot of people seem to be like, oh, yes, I feed on player tears. And I'm like, okay, when you say you feed on player tears... what does that mean?
Yeah, Matthew told the story on the podcast a while back about the first time he ever encountered Changeling the Lost. At some point, every single player cried.
Yep.
Except him. And he was kind of like, what is this game? This is very weird. Because he hadn't really encountered that before.
Right.
But there are a lot of people, that's what they get out of games like Changeling. Yep. Because it is very much a game of survival and, you know, of personal trauma.
Yep. That's why I love it.
Yeah, no, that's always been the one. I mean, anyone that knows me and Jax and a couple of other friends know that we all call ourselves, you know,
Spring Queen, Autumn Queen.
Spring Queen, Winter Queen, Autumn Queen. We're all very connected to Changeling the Lost. It's been a game that I've loved for a long time. And...
Changeling the Lost actually got me into therapy.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
How so? Is that like a story that you want to talk about? Or is that just like a throwaway funny line?
So I was raised in a homeschool family,
mm-hmm.
and there were some things that were very much capital N, not normal.
Okay.
That happened in my life that
right.
I prefer not to elaborate on right now.
That's fine.
But Changeling the Lost, reading it for the first time, was like, I can have these mixed emotions about a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I realized there was a gap, and I was making a face, and it was my ellipsis face of doing... essentially, if you use a Mac, it's like the spinning beach ball.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The spinning beach ball face of, what? So, it was, Changeling the Lost very much got me into therapy, because it was the first game that was like, hey, you can feel these mixed emotions about a situation, and that doesn't necessarily mean you're wrong.
Yeah. So, I'm going to actually go back a little bit to kind of one of the things we talked about in the beginning, and that's what got you into gaming in general? Because I know that you do have the homeschool background and everything, and a bunch of stuff, so, like, how did you get into role-playing games from that? Because it seems like a hard environment to get into them from.
Yeah, so my dad... grew up in a military family.
Okay.
And never had a son. It's me and my sister.
Mm-hmm.
And he just started telling me D&D stories when I was little and reading me stuff like The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
Because he used to play D&D in college.
Oh, okay.
And so my homeschooling environment was actually more secular than a lot of them.
Right.
Because I was actually homeschooled due to my ADHD and not mm-hmm. due to religious background stuff specifically, even though my family is Catholic. But no, my dad just got me really into role-playing. Mm-hmm. I played Diablo when I was 6, which may explain some things. I got into Neverwinter Nights when I was 8.
Uh-huh.
We're watching this cat, like, precariously stare at this microphone, and it is intense. It is, like, you can hear horror violins. This cat is just like, am I gonna wreck the recording? I don't know.
This is seriously the most interrupted podcast I've ever recorded by the cats, and it's because usually we record, when it's just me, Eddie, and Matthew, we record in the mornings,
mm-hmm.
and the cats sleep until about 4 p.m.
Gotcha.
And then also, I've done a couple of night recordings, but it's always been after my roommates are home.
Oh.
So the cats have something else to entertain them. But right now, Jax and I are the most interesting thing in the house.
Well, it's because I'm the most interesting thing in any room I'm in.
True.
It's true.
So, yeah, so one of the cats is just the worst, and I tell him that a lot.
Give me.
Here you go.
I will take him. He is beautiful. Oh, he's mad. He mad.
All right, there's another cat segue brought to you by Bebop.
Bye, big man boy.
Okay.
Oh, he's going to try it again. He's going to try it.
I don't know how much that's going to cut out, but probably some of it. I don't even know. Anyway, so you got into it via...
Yeah, via my dad. And then I actually had a homeschool group that was playing D&D because the parents of the person GMing at the time were like, oh, well, this is a great activity where you can socialize and do math, you know, math
mm-hmm.
and be creative. And I got really into it then. And I actually didn't get into other systems until college.
Okay.
Because, like, Baby Jax was very, very good at sort of us versus them tribalism. Adult okay. Jax is not so good at that anymore.
Right.
Like, yeah, sometimes to my detriment. But, I was like, oh, D&D is the only, you know, the only real thing. Everything else is just copying D&D. And luckily I grew out of that.
Right.
Because as much as I do enjoy D&D, it is not A. It is not the only thing out there.
No, totally. And that, it's kind of funny, because, like, even though D&D was the first game I ever played when I was very young,
mm-hmm.
the first game I really super got into was Vampire the Masquerade,
because mm-hmm.
that was what was big with the goth and punk kids in high school. Yeah. So, you know.
No, the first non-D&D game I ever really got into was Changeling the Lost.
That's really cool. That's actually not most people's entree into, like, World of Darkness, Chronicles of Darkness.
Oh, no, it wasn't. It wasn't my entrance was actually Exalted.
That's even stranger.
Yeah. Well, I got thrown into an Exalted game my first, I went to a club in college, which is actually where I met my husband,
mm-hmm.
Where it was different weekly games, and I had just picked up the World of Darkness Blue Book.
Okay.
2 weeks earlier, because I wanted to, you know, look at something new, and I was like, oh my god, this is amazing!
Right.
This was the first edition before it was Chronicles.
Oh, yeah.
And then they're like, oh, you're a new World of Darkness player. You should play Exalted. And I'd never played World of Darkness before. Just read it.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, I will play Exalted, even though I have no idea what this is.
Yeah.
Now I'm writing for it, so that's cool.
True. Yeah, you're working on a couple things for it mm-hmm. right now. Cause you just did a section in Heirs of the Shogunate, didn't you?
Yep, Forest Witches. Yep. Oh, my God.
And then you're doing Across the Eight Directions.
Yep.
Which is going to be super fun.
It's going to be good.
So, just because we like giving little previews on here, if we can, what is it about the Forest Witches that you enjoyed writing?
Well, the Forest Witches were extremely difficult. I'm not going to lie to you. Because in order to write the Forest Witches, I had to first perform Mirandamancy.
Okay.
Mirandamancy has two different meanings.
Okay.
One is that you are able to seamlessly bend system and form.
Okay.
Because Jenna Moran, formerly Rebecca Borgstrom, this is also sometimes referred to as Borgstromancy.
Okay.
Is actually a computer engineer, I believe.
Okay.
Or something, but she very much has this headspace of system and form and functions that seamlessly blend.
Right.
which is why you get something like the Sidereals book for first edition, which was very much this bureaucratic slog, but it was a great, great book, because if you started seeing the pattern she had encoded in there, then you could use loopholes and essentially own the universe, which is what being a Sidereal is about.
Right.
Which brings me to my second point. Moranomancy is when you have to translate the things Jenna Moran says and understand them. And that was difficult. So I reached out to my good friend John Sneed, who all of us know and like.
Oh, yeah.
And he put me in touch with Jenna, and I was like, hey, I'm doing Forest Witches. I'm a little terrified. Please help me. What am I doing?
Right.
And she sends me back this 11-paragraph email of essentially step-by-step instructions of how to build a small Jenna Moran in your head so that you can process Jenna Moran.
That's a lot.
It's a lot.
But it got
done. I'm not fully convinced she isn't just a pixie living somewhere in Seattle.
Possibly.
But, like, she has her own language, and it's beautiful and incredible and thoroughly inscrutable.
Right. So do you feel like you were able then to channel that a little bit in the writing?
I think so, yeah.
Is there anything, like, super cool that you put in there that you're excited about? Because I don't know as much about the Forest Witches aside from what we've discussed on the Slack. Because we were talking about them as a group well before we asked you to write them. And kept going, like, what do we want to do with this? How do we do it?
Something I had no idea about the Forest Witches is that they're literally just building an augmented reality.
Right.
When I hear Forest Witches, that's not what I think.
Right, you kind of think Changeling, actually.
Yeah, you really do. Or, like, weird Appalachian sorcery, which is also my jam.
Right.
But one of the things I did is, in the first edition, the city in the real creation, not the augmented creation, that the people live in, the Forest Witches live in, doesn't have a name.
Okay.
But in third edition, we gave it a name, which is actually the name of the guardian spirit, which is Orethia.
Okay.
And the city is just referred to as Orethia, instead of, like, having Orethia being just the spirit of the city, because she's doing everything for the Forest Witches. Right. You can read a little bit of Orethia's background in Heirs to the Shogunate, but essentially, she's this embodied spirit that provides houses, food, clothing, basically anything the Forest Witches could want.
Right.
And it's just odd to me that they didn't just call the city Orethia.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that's what the city is.
Right.
It's just her.
It, like, both is that and should be called that.
Yes.
Because, yeah.
So that was something I was really happy about, is actually just sort of getting to put her more toward the fore.
That's very cool. I can't wait to read more of the Heirs content, because, you know, peek behind the curtain, a lot of people don't realize, like, just because I am the overseer for Exalted, like, I haven't read the books that are still being written. I don't really read them until the editing process.
Mm-hmm.
So every now and then somebody will come to me and, like, ask me questions about things like Chicago by Night or Heirs to the Shogunate, and I'm like, I honestly have only read the outline so far.
Yep.
Eric and Vance do all the actual developing, so they've read it all.
They're
not me.
Great.
I love
By
them.
By the way.
They are fantastic. I'm really excited for Across the Eight Directions. It's going to be a fun book. We just started in first drafts on that at the time of this recording, so we just kind of sent out assignments or talking to people.
I think I have, like, 7,000 words in that book.
Yeah,
something.
I think so.
Yeah.
What was really funny about that was I try to turn off my work stuff for the weekend, because otherwise I'm just constantly working forever.
Yep.
And I came back to the Exalted Slack this morning, because it's Monday, guys. It's Monday morning, just so you know. I'm full disclosure.
Yay!
And I came back to the Slack, and there had been an Across the Eight Directions channel created that had hundreds of messages that I had not seen.
Yeah,
I just
I just don't touch the channels
That's
anymore.
Fine. You don't have to. It is optional if
I
you
know.
Need them. But
I really prefer Discord to Slack.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys.
That's okay. We just use the tools that people have already set up for the most part.
Oh, it's all good.
Anyway, so that's one thing that you've been working on. Is there anything else you're excited about you've been working on recently?
Oh, gosh. I've been in a bit of a lull because I got married in October, and there's been a bunch of family drama, and I'm moving in December, so I'm sort of in a very small freeze.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm doing Across the Eight Directions. I will probably be working on the Changeling Kith book, because I wrote the rules for the Changeling Kiths.
Right.
But we haven't gotten an outline for that yet.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm like, to go back to an earlier topic, I am solo writing and developing a very short, like maybe 50 pages or less, book for Cult Divinity Lost.
Oh, okay.
Which is just going to be called Bound, Caged, Abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why it's not Abandoned, Bound, Caged, or like ABCs or whatever.
Yeah, because then it would be the ABC book.
Yeah, I know. It would be great. But essentially what it's going to be is very clearly spelling out all of the kinds of traumatic events you could encounter in cult,
uh-huh.
why you might encounter them, and how to use them properly.
Right.
Which is something I'm very excited about, because it gets to deal with trauma I'm familiar with, like accidents or natural disasters, and, you know, sexual violence, and domestic violence, and also stuff I'm not as familiar with, but some of my friends are, like addiction, or incarceration,
right,
or all, you know, or war. And one of my favorite parts of the book is in the war and other physical violence section, because I just lumped it all together. It was, how many pages of the cult rulebook are dedicated to violence? Dedicated to inflicting physical violence on other people.
Right. And?
And count that, and now see how focused this game is, or any game is, on violence.
Mm-hmm.
And how that might affect your character, because in real life, a lot of people don't really enjoy inflicting violence on other people.
Right.
And in the old version of cult, actually killing someone was a huge hit to what's referred to as your mental balance.
Right.
I really like how cult does sanity or whatever. I don't like sanity systems in games. Like,
right.
Just for reference.
Okay.
I really do not enjoy sanity systems in games, mostly because they're not particularly nuanced.
Right.
And they're like, oh, well, if you sit and drink a cup of coffee and meditate on a thing, then you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't read books, you're fine. The Call Out of Cthulhu.
I do love Call of Cthulhu, but I agree that I think sanity systems could be a little bit more nuanced in general. Yeah. As somebody who, I've been very candid about it, like, I have mental illness.
Same,
I struggle with that. So do, honestly, most of my friends, I'm not gonna lie. Yep. Like, most people I know, even in the industry, have something. Even if it's just small bouts of anxiety, most people have something that they're dealing with.
Yep.
And, it's getting to a point where when I see, like, a straight, you know, you have gone insane thing, I'm like, that means...
What does that mean?
18,000 different things, depending on, you know, what mental illness you're talking about, so...
Clinically insane? Chemically insane.
Yeah.
You know, were you deprived of something? Okay, so I'm gonna admit a shameful thing.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yes.
So I really liked Cthulhu Tech when I first read it.
Okay.
Cthulhu Tech is really, really bad. This is not reflective views of Onyx Path, this reflects the views of Jax, who is pugnacious and horrible. But...
Our guests all have their own views. We totally allow that.
Yeah. But the thing about Cthulhu Tech is I wanted to like it really badly.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first read it and wasn't reading it critically, I overlooked a lot of its flaws. Like the Nazi-powered rape machine. Sorry, the steam-powered Nazi rape machine. Sorry about that.
And I feel like, since I came to the industry a little bit backwards and weird, one of the only things I know about Cthulhu Tech is that thing. Because I've just seen other people talk about it.
The concept is really cool.
Uh-huh.
It's Neon Genesis Evangelion with Cthulhu.
Okay.
And, like, there are arcologies that have their own rich life.
Right.
And, you know, you can experiment with magic, and it actually has a really interesting sort of beginning of a cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I like about Cthulhu Tech that I could absolutely say is not problematic is Aeon War Syndrome, which is their version of insanity.
Okay.
Aeon War Syndrome is literally just environmental PTSD.
Right.
It's essentially humans realizing they're part of an extinction-level event,
mm-hmm.
and all of them have some form of trauma from this, whether they know it or not.
Right.
So their sanity system is actually just Aeon War Syndrome.
Okay. And yeah, that makes sense to me on some level. And I mean, it does make sense that in games like Call of Cthulhu, just because we mentioned it, you know, seeing certain things would be disturbing.
Yep.
But the question of how it would disturb you or how you would answer it, I think almost is better on a character by character basis.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And this isn't, you know.
I don't like that they call it insanity. That's my thing. Like, yes, obviously, once you see something like Cthulhu, you're going to have a much different view of the world.
Right.
Than you would if you hadn't seen something like Cthulhu.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean you're insane.
Right.
It means your frame of reference has changed. Now, you may appear as though you are severely, I don't know, schizophrenic, bipolar, having auditory hallucinations, whatever.
Right.
But it doesn't mean you're insane.
Yeah. I think that's one of those points of language, too, and of society that's currently still really hardcore evolving.
Uh-huh.
Because I know that, I mean, all of us are guilty of it on the podcast, and every now and then we'll do it, and we'll kind of shake our heads, or we'll be like, oh, that's insane, oh, that's crazy, because it's such a normal, has been for so long, way to talk. But also, you know, there are other things that I've managed to remove from my personal lexicon, so I've been working on that one as well. I definitely still do it, and definitely feel a little bad every time I do, just so y'all know.
I mean, I've been starting to use crazy more as a self-descriptor, or...
Yeah.
Because... It's just easier a lot of times to tell people, hey, you know, I'm crazy. I have a list of symptoms longer than your arm. And it's fine for people who have mental illness to self-identify as crazy or mad. One of my favorite authors, Clementine Morrigan, who does an amazing zine called Fucking Magic, which you should all check out, even if you don't have trauma, just to sort of explore that really vulnerable, beautiful headspace.
Mm-hmm.
But she talks about reclaiming the term madness and how people who were essentially prisoners of psychiatric institutions who wanted to have their trauma dealt with and instead got medicated to be compliant.
Right.
People like that can reclaim the term mad.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, I'm always open for people to self-identify as a thing.
Yeah.
If that is a thing that they are.
Absolutely.
Even if the terminology makes me uncomfortable.
Right.
Because there are definitely certain things, both in that and in the, you know, LGBTQ+ community, where every now and then somebody will say something, and I'll be like, oh, it's a slur. And then I'll be like, wait, who's using it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's fine.
They can say that. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I just have a knee-jerk reaction still to certain words. And
A lot of people do.
Yeah. And I'm trying really hard to kind of move away from saying things are crazy or insane or whatever.
Yep.
Just because that's for so long that's been
I've been part using of the language. Ridic.
Yeah.
That's ridic.
I feel pretty comfortable saying ridiculous. I feel yeah.
Absurd. Seems a good one.
There are other great words out there, y'all. Let's talk about language.
Yay.
I love it. So we are getting a little short on time, although depending on how much of the cat shenanigans I cut out, we might not be. But is there any other, are there any other things that you wanted to touch on as far as trauma, game design, as far as any of your personal philosophies on those things? I mean, this is interviews about you, so.
So, one of the things I wanted to talk about is I went to a LARP this weekend.
Uh-huh.
And I failed to emotionally regulate.
Okay.
Which sucked, because it meant I sort of exploded into 1,000 metaphorical pieces of particulate matter, which then splashed onto a bunch of other people.
Can you explain emotional regulation a little bit in terms of what you need to do for a LARP?
Sure. So, I'm actually just going to explain it a little more generally.
Yeah, go for it.
In terms of safety mechanics, there is a certain amount of buy-in you have to have with safety mechanics.
Right.
If safety mechanics are provided for you, it is expected that even if you don't use them, you at least see them as an option.
Right.
Like, if a fade-out mechanic is provided, if you are, you know, getting too heated or you think someone might be in danger, just fade out.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it never gets to that point, realize that it's an option.
Right.
Essentially, checking in on yourself, making sure you're okay, figuring out what's up with you.
Right.
That's emotional regulation.
Okay.
I was at a LARP this weekend, and I've been having some issues with my dad recently.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't really taken super well to the whole Jax is married thing. And two of my character's male friends or mentors actually got ganked.
Okay.
Like, permanently.
Oh, okay.
This game. And I didn't realize how much that was hurting me until I was in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of flipped out on several people and ran off.
Okay.
And that was really bad. And I felt super ashamed after that because I'm a safety expert. I wrote White Wolf's safety rules. I wrote that bit on, you know, not having fascists at your table.
Right.
I'm the one people come... Well, I'm one of the people people come to when they need safety stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I just blew it, right?
Yeah.
The game had a safety marshal.
Okay.
So I went to her and I'm like, I realize I hurt people.
Right.
Please tell me how I hurt them and how I can make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just spent 2 hours crying to her about what was going on in my life and why I failed to emotionally regulate and how we could fix it in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And something that we talked about afterwards when she checked in on me after the game, which is awesome.
Right.
Is even therapists need a therapist?
Right.
Like, I can be a safety consultant all I want. That doesn't mean I'm going to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
At it. And that made me feel a lot better because even in games with the most perfect safety systems,
right,
there are gonna be fuck-ups.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's something that I think we can take into games and also, I mean, even in friendships. Like, yep. I'll totally admit I had an anxiety thing a couple weeks ago and ended up blowing something really out of proportion in my own brain and almost ruining a relationship.
Oh.
With somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, it got worked out fairly quickly, and yep. It was fine, and I apologized, and that happens. But, I'm someone who's been in and out of therapy and off and on medication for years.
Same.
Like, I supposedly know how to manage my anxiety and depression at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I did not in that moment. And nope. That's just a thing that happens. So, whether it's in-game or whatever, like, yeah, people are gonna screw up. Like, don't... If you are playing a game and you don't use the safety rules of that game properly, or if you're running a game and it doesn't happen properly...
Yeah. Or even if you're running a game and you start to feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. Like, know that you can course correct.
Yeah.
And that, hopefully, you know, if everything goes well, mm-hmm. that it's a mistake that can be moved past and learned from.
Yeah.
Because that's the important thing, is that if you make these mistakes, or you do actually, like, really... emotionally hurt somebody else accidentally or get emotionally hurt accidentally.
Yeah.
If you all talk about it and you all kind of work through it and you make sure it won't happen again in the future.
Yeah.
And make sure all those rules are in place and that you're actually abiding by them and following them and mm-hmm. keeping an eye on them. That's important. Because, I mean, honestly, I've not encountered yet in the LARP a situation that made me emotionally uncomfortable just because my LARP history is so, so, so small.
Right.
But I also know that as somebody who has anxiety and is a people pleaser, I have to work extra hard to make sure I use things like safety mechanics.
Same.
Because I am more willing to be like, oh, we'll just go along with it.
Yep.
We'll just go along with it.
Mm-hmm.
And last time I did that in a LARP, when I was 18 years old, I didn't LARP for 15 years.
Yeah.
Because I just went along with some people who were being pretty inappropriate with me.
Right.
And was just trying to be cool.
Yeah.
And sometimes, just don't be cool.
Yeah. So, safety mechanics, if you take anything away from this episode, apart from the cats, safety mechanics are there to give you a voice in the conversation. They're there to open that dialogue and to make it as easy to open that dialogue as it is to ask your GM a question about a rules clarification, right?
Right.
It gives you, I don't know, I guess a ritual for how to do it?
Kind of,
it
yeah.
It sort of ritualizes it and makes it more mechanical and standard.
Yeah, and if you can make it a habit to check in with people, that's great. Like, I have had people check in with me at conventions, at games I was playing, even though I wasn't feeling bad at all.
Right.
But it was kind of nice to see it happen, to see someone kind of go, like, hey, you all right? And I was like, yeah, totally. I don't know why I wouldn't be, but I understand that for somebody else, what's happening right now might bother them.
Or might look like you're uncomfortable.
Right, exactly. Because sometimes, you know, when you're playing a game, you're acting uncomfortable.
Yep.
That's the role you're playing. Yeah.
Like, if this weekend, the first time ever, I gave a hand waggle to the okay check-in. This was before I exploded.
Mm-hmm.
This was, like, when I was sort of starting to ramp up to it.
Right.
And that felt big
yeah.
for me, because normally I'm just like, yeah, thumbs up, I'm golden.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, knowing your own emotions and knowing where your head is,
yeah.
that's important. But also kind of checking on other people,
yeah.
you know, I'm...
And
yeah.
if you fuck up, you're not... evil, it's fine. But you have to have the follow-through.
Exactly.
This is something that sort of gets me when people talk about restorative justice, especially in gaming communities,
uh-huh.
is a lot of people forget that there needs to be a follow-through.
Right.
Restorative justice is like, oh, well, we should let them back into our community after a certain period of time. Great. Why?
Yeah, what have they done to change or to better themselves or to make amends or...
Yeah. In my case, what I did, and... like, I can only speak to this because I specifically asked the game runners both after the game had ended and a day after the game had ended, do you still want me to come back to your LARP?
Mm-hmm.
Was, I talked to the safety marshal.
Right.
I made apologies in the way people wanted me to make apologies.
Mm-hmm.
I checked in with everybody after the LARP had ended and a day after the LARP had ended. And I will likely continue doing so this week.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it very clear that I was going to start prioritizing my character's healing and the play of other people around me
mm-hmm.
as part of this experience.
Right.
Instead of just diving so deeply into myself that I can't come out, which is not great, and I don't recommend it, because a lot of LARPs are like, oh, well, you should go really deep inside yourself. That's fine. When you're doing it because you're dissociating, like I was, no.
Yeah.
Step out of game. It's okay. They will survive without you.
And that applies to LARP, or it applies
to... Or tabletop.
To, yeah, if... Well, that's what I was going to say. It was like, also, if you're ever playing a game of anything, whether it's, you know, D&D, Vampire, Cult, whatever.
Yeah.
If you need to just get up and walk away from the table, do it.
Yep.
Do it. Take care of yourself. That's something that I tell people all the time, is like, if you have that moment, don't try to, like, tough it out for your friends. Don't try to, like, you know, just make yourself be cool with it because everybody else is.
Don't do it.
If you're not okay, walk away.
If you feel uncomfortable just kind of walking away, that's fine. Go, hey, guys, you know, I'm feeling sick. Or, hey, I really need to do something tomorrow. It's okay to invent an excuse.
Yeah.
It's a game. This is something I keep telling people in gaming, because there's a lot of people who get super into it and don't want to come out.
Mm-hmm.
It's a game. If you're not having fun...
Or enjoying it.
Or enjoying it! If you are not engaged with this material in a way that is positive for you...
Right.
It's okay to walk away, because... I'm going to lay into you with a little guilt trip here, because I know this is sometimes the only way I can listen to advice like this.
Okay.
You're playing it wrong. If you're trying to enjoy it when you're not enjoying it, and you're trying to force yourself to enjoy it,
yep.
and you're beating yourself up because you can't enjoy it, you're playing the game wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a big difference between so someone like me who occasionally has to get over some anxiety before I can enjoy a game, but actually knowing I will have fun if I just give it 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And actively not enjoying what you're doing and trying to push through it for the sake of the other people involved.
Yeah.
Like, if you're actively not having fun or enjoying it or whatever, if you're not getting anything out of it, if it is hurting you, whether it's, you know, usually just emotionally, hopefully not physically.
Yeah.
But in some LARPs, who knows? But yeah, if that's happening, like, I've been very big on... I don't like playing things set in high schools, because I was super, super bullied all through high school and middle school. And I don't want that to happen again, because I'm afraid somebody's going to touch on something about my appearance or about me being annoying or whatever that will just make me not okay.
Yeah, I don't like playing games with torture mechanics.
Yeah.
Now, okay, there are exceptions to that. But when I say, okay, let me clarify that a little bit. I don't like playing games where... The idea of, if you torture this person, you will get an important clue or an answer.
Oh, yeah.
I really hate that, and I will not play in games where torture is expected to be used as an active means of gaining information.
Right. So, you know, I said we were close to time, but I actually want to end this on an upbeat note.
Hooray!
So, why don't you talk about Honobono games and what they are and why you love them?
Oh, man, I love Honobono games so much, you guys! So much! Okay, so basically at this point, I only play horror and honobono games, and they're, like, completely opposite.
I love that dichotomy.
At some point, I really just want to combine them and have, like, an adorable monster social or something.
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's do it. It'll be great. But basically, honobono is a Japanese term for pastoral fantasy, basically. It is the aesthetic you see in Ghibli movies.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the most famous example. The most famous game that uses honobono... aesthetics is Golden Sky Stories,
right?
Which actually has no violence mechanics at all, and all of your powers are based on how well you are caring for the people around you and how well they are caring for you.
I love that so much.
It's so cute. You're little shape-shifting animal spirits that help people in a small village.
That's amazing.
It's so good.
So are you, like... I know you've been talking about, like, working on some of those. Is that still something that you're kind of playing around in
your head? I am playing around with, yes. I actually just did a panel with Rach Shelke at Metatopia about how you can put Honobono into basically any setting and not just do, you know, Japanese pastoral fantasy. Wow, I'm realizing my voice is breaking now and I kind of wish I'd had some water, but that's okay. I'll have soup when I get home.
For the record, I offered her water and she declined.
I was very stubborn because I'm still trying to regulate from this weekend. But one of the things we sort of talked about is you can find that sort of joy in, like, a city as well. Or you can find that joy basically in whatever setting makes you happy. Like, one of the things that I'm talking about with another designer is doing a cyberpunk Honobono game.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. I actually wrote for the Golden Cobras this year. I didn't win, sadly. But a cyberpunk game called Send Nudes.
Yes.
Which is about a noodle shop.
Right.
Where you are either playing the service staff, who all have their own hopes and dreams and wants and desires and whatever.
Uh-huh.
Or you're playing a cyberpunk stereotype who's coming in and having noodles.
Right. And I love stuff like that. Like, yeah. Little, like, slice of life things. Uh-huh. I mean, as a big fan of games like Stardew Valley, which does have...
Oh my god. I actually talked to Eric Barone about possibly doing a Stardew Valley tabletop, and he's like, I will get back to you at some point. So Eric, if you're listening to this, I'm still waiting for you to get back to me, because I really, really want to do that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's I love games like that. Like, I've always loved little, like, harvesting, farming, simulation games. I was never one of those people who played The Sims and, like, murdered people. I played The Sims and just made people, like, really smart and happy.
Yeah, no, like, I do the legacy challenge on The Sims and, like, try and make 10 generations of a family, starting from, like, super humble beginnings and then growing from there.
Right, so I've always loved that kind of thing. So I did not know the term Honobono until you said it to me at one point. And then I kind of started looking more into it, because I was like, wait, this is a thing I actually really love, because I've always been a fan of Ghibli films and all the other things that you
mentioned. It's actually kind of funny, because a couple of my male friends have been talking about comfort games, and I'm like, guys, there's already a term for this.
So, all right, so we're going to end on that comforting, happy note.
Yeah.
Where can people find you on social media if they want to hear you yell about all these things?
I yell so much on social media.
She's really good at it, though. She's a good follow.
Thank you. Please do not friend me on Facebook unless you tell me who the hell you are, because I've been declining so many people recently, because all these game designers are like, Jax, I want to be your friend, and I'm like, that's great, I don't know you.
Yep.
The cat came back the very next day.
Or, you know, 5 minutes later.
Thought he was a goner. Sorry, that's an old Canadian song that nobody but Ian will get.
I know that song.
Do you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I've known that song since I was a kid. I think it was on, like, a Raffi album or something that when makes I sense. Was, like, four. Or possibly Sharon Lewis and Brim, which I used to watch. Anyway.
But...
Total tangent.
Hi, Ian. But yeah, you can find me on Twitter as Rufflejax. I don't know. No, I do know that you can find me on Twitter as Rufflejax. I don't know what that noise was. You can absolutely find me on Twitter as Rufflejax. I've said it 3 times now, so it sticks with you. You can find me on DriveThruRPG as Jacqueline Brick. You can find me on Tumblr as Tactical Nymphomania, which is a way too long of a story to be telling right now.
That is a great Tumblr handle. I know. I didn't realize that was your Tumblr handle.
It is. You can find me on Pinterest, also as Rufflejax. Yeah.
Sounds good. Well, thank you so much for coming over and doing this incredibly cat-laden interview.
I was really happy about the cats. It made me feel less silly.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a Monarchies of Mal LARP in here every day.
I love him. Bebop is a him, right?
Bebop, they are all hymns in this house, yes.
Oh, okay.
Bebop, Rocksteady, and Apollo.
Right.
So, Bebop is the worst, though, in all capital letters. He's so good. He's literally biting my hand right now, Jax.
He's so good.
Well, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
And welcome back to the outro. Wait, do you welcome people back
just
to...
Just briefly, though, aren't we? Because that was a long interview.
I mean, it wasn't... our interviews run between 45 minutes and an hour 15, depending. This one was kind of right in the middle. I think one of the longer ones was Dave Brickshaw, just because he has so much to say. But it's all interesting, so...
Yeah, sure. Whereas this one had a surfeit of Bebop, so...
I'm not even going to lie, like, right as we were recording the end of the intro, Bebop wandered down the stairs, and I was just, like, side-eyeing him, like, you are not gonna start this again, are you? Like, this is the
Bebop. We are not friends right now, Bebop.
I have already told my roommates, because it's one of the things is that they are not my cats, which I'm not sure I was completely clear about in the episode. They're my roommates' cats. And because of where my office is, I can't shut them out. Like, there's no
right.
door. There's just stairs that lead down to where I work. So I've already told Laura, I'm like, next time that I have a recording, if he comes down here even once, he is getting locked in the bedroom upstairs for the duration.
Right.
But either way, with or without Kat, I think that was a fun interview.
It was.
Yeah. It was very enlightening. I was going to ask the two of you something. Have you read Jax's cult scenario that's in Taroticum and other tales?
I have not.
No, I haven't.
Oh, well, I very much recommend it. I recommend it to the listeners as well. If you're at all interested in the body and Gnostic horror of Cult Divinity Lost, Jax puts together a horrifying political scenario in Taroticum, one of the books that came out with the core book release. And there's one of my scenarios in there as well, but who cares about that? Jax has a very good grasp of sort of a very pernicious personal horror that that could exist in a campaign staffer's office. I wonder where she gets that experience from.
Yeah,
no idea.
We didn't talk about that at all, but Jax does work in politics for her day job, so... That's, I honestly kind of wish we had talked about that more, because that's always super fascinating to me when, you know, when we talked to Megan Fitzgerald, which was our first interview back in the day, we got to talk about her working at NASA. And it's always just kind of interesting because some of these books and some of these writers and developers will have fans that don't even realize they have day jobs. And then
right.
some of them have fascinating day jobs to the point where a couple of them, and I won't name names, have jobs that we can't really talk about when they come on for
yeah.
interviews. And that's
yeah.
that's so interesting to me, that it's just like, you know, for three of us at least, this is our day job. But for a long time, I mean, when I was just freelance editing, my main 40 hours a week was at a makeup store. And so I talked about that a little bit at the Gen Con panel, but a lot of folks also don't associate, you know, the role-playing industry with people that really like makeup, and I'm like, I'm both, and you can be both. Anybody can be both. You can contain multitudes. And yeah, that's part of why talking to Jax is so interesting, is because she's been doing the LARP and RPG community for a long time, for as young as she is,
mm-hmm.
and she's encountered a whole lot of different play styles and a whole lot of different systems, and she very much knows what she's into, I think, at this point. I do recommend, it'll be in the show notes, check out her DriveThruRPG page, because a lot of her kind of smaller self-published LARPs are not only beautiful, many of them had either layout or just covers done by Meredith Gerber, who's one of our other colleagues. But they're also super interesting, because she's a fantastic writer. So I do recommend checking her out. I definitely recommend checking out Bluebeard's Bride, which of course we went on at length about in the
right.
interview. That's because it's a really fun game. I first saw that at I think it was Vox Unplugged last year, actually, where we will be next weekend.
Yes.
I think it was Danielle, the Requiem developer, who kind of grabbed me and dragged me over to the booth and said, like, you have to look at this book, and put Bluebeard's Bride in my hands. And I was like, this is so beautiful. I need this in my life.
It is.
So yeah, check out all those things. I don't know if anybody else had any other things they wanted to say or plug for this.
Oh, no.
I know the Chicago by Night Kickstarter is still going on.
Yes.
Which is cool. And yes, Eddie, what'd you have?
No, I mean, I was going to let you do the Chicago promo first.
Well, as I'm glad you mentioned it. So yes, the Chicago by Night Kickstarter is still raging on, and it's done... Okay, so cards on the table. City Source Books for World of Darkness never did very well.
Mm-hmm.
They never sold very well in historic editions. There's often this misnomer that the original Chicago by Night sold well, and so did its second edition, and New York by Night, and so on, and they just didn't.
No.
And the reason often being that people see a city by night book and they think, well, that's not my city, and so they don't buy it.
Right.
And I can understand that. But this book, as a result, has exceeded our expectations. We were aware of that reservation when people were looking at it. But it seems enough people are taking it as it is meant, which is While it is a book that is set in the city of Chicago, there is so much in it that can be used for any other city. And Chicago is essentially being portrayed as a campaign setting for Vampire the Masquerade. That's the term I keep using when describing this book to people, because when people think of Dungeons and Dragons, they think of the Forgotten Realms campaign setting, and they might think of the Dale Lands or Waterdeep as a common place to adventure. And that's exactly what we've done with Chicago here. It's a campaign setting with so many story hooks and so many characters and lovely little facets that you can explore.
Yeah.
That I'm so glad people are getting that. And I would hate for anyone to have any resistance about backing just because of where it's set.
Well, yeah, and just because a lot of these events or all of the non-fictional events are from Chicago doesn't mean you can't fudge them and put them in New York or Atlanta or Seattle or anywhere that you would like to play the game. Like, it's a fictional world still. So,
oh,
yeah.
Definitely. One of the lore sheets we have in this book relates to essentially urban disasters and your character's involvement in them, whether it's as a savior of the city or a constant saboteur. And so Chicago is known for the Great Fire of Chicago, which occurred in the late 19th century and has undergone various riots as well throughout its history, union riots especially, and organized crime. But the lore sheet makes it quite explicit that you can transpose this to any city that's had historic events, and most cities have had historic events occur at least a few times in the last century. So, yeah, I very much think that you could use Chicago by Night for ideas for your own domains and get an awful lot of value out of it.
Also, I've seen the Oblivion rules, and they are sweet.
Good.
Of course. And is your Q&A still up on your YouTube channel, Matthew?
It is. We'll probably upload it to the Onyx Path channel as well at some point. But myself and three of the writers for Chicago by Night, John Burke, Clara Herbel, and Mike Tomasek, we got on Hangouts, did a live stream on my YouTube channel, The Gentleman Gamer, to talk about Chicago by Night. We answered viewers' questions live, and we covered a hell of a lot of ground.
Yeah.
So I very much recommend checking it out. It's a long one, and if it's a bit too long for you, I also did an interview about the book on the VTM 25 podcast, which is a fantastic Vampire the Masquerade podcast that has basically covered every single source book that has come out for Vampire since its inception. Every episode reviews a different book.
Wow. Yeah.
And the detail they go into is magnificent. The hosts are wonderful, and I very much recommend checking out their podcast, as long as it isn't at the expense of you listening to ours.
Right.
Let that pass through your head.
But eventually you'll be done with ours, you'll be caught up, and then you can move on to other podcasts, as long as you come back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once a week. We're always here. You can't get rid of us. Yeah, it's actually funny with the AMA. I was driving. I was on about an hour and a half drive when you were doing the Q&A, Ask Me Anything on the YouTube channel. So I just plugged it in through my car speakers and listened to it the whole time. Because nice. I was interested in what was going to happen. But I also, can't watch YouTube and drive. But luckily, you don't have to watch it. So if it's something that you want to put on in the background while you're just hanging out, it's actually really good for that. It doesn't need to be visual. So.
Isn't it frustrating, though, that YouTube doesn't have an audio-only app?
Yes, I was really annoyed I couldn't turn my screen off, I'm not going to lie. Because I just had to turn my phone upside down in the passenger seat the whole time, so it wasn't distracting me because it was nighttime. Right. So I was like, I don't want this like bright light in this seat next to me. But yes, I do wish I could do audio-only on YouTube, especially because a lot of people use it just for music. It's like, that would make sense, but I don't know. What are you going to do? Eddie, did you have something earlier, or have we gone so far past that it's pointless now?
Well, I mean, we have, but I do want to kind of dig back to it because it's you guys touched on really well, I thought, the entertainment versus fun thing, which has been kind of an informal thread through a lot of our episodes recently. And I think it's really cool to have dug into that because especially a lot of the games we make, we don't make games that are explicitly, obviously fun. And so, I mean, that was a really good conversation. And I think that at some point in time, I think it would be good for us to kind of dig into that whole topic. Then we'll keep dancing around it. But it was nice to hear just two other people talking about that and kind of trying to come to terms to using language about why something can be compelling but not explicitly inherently enjoyable, you know?
Right.
So yeah, it was good. It was really good, and it was nice to hear Jax kind of articulate that, and just to hear the other people are talking and thinking about that, because it is such a complex topic, especially when you work in things that are explicitly labeled games. To be able to say not all games need to be quote unquote fun.
Yeah, well, that's something that, like, every time that we kind of touch on it, we just kind of go, you know, what is fun? Da, da, da. But yeah, Jax dove into it a little bit better, going like, it can be entertaining or, as you just said, compelling without being fun. Like, I watch a lot of, you know, period dramas and things as far as my movie intake goes. Are they fun? Not usually.
Right.
Are they interesting? Compelling? Am I, you know, there for it? Yeah. Like, I'm one of those people who consumes media that I know will make me cry.
Right.
So am I still being entertained? Or am I just compelling? Or am I just emotionally invested in it? And yeah, I think that would be a really fun topic for us to cover. Possibly if we could all actually coordinate to read that A Theory of Fun book that you keep mentioning.
Yes.
Because if we all read that and kind of discuss our thoughts on it, you know, with the book as kind of a thread, would I think be a really fun thing to do. It won't be like next week, people, because that I don't have time to read anything ever.
To be fair, A Theory of Fun is a very short book, so I mean, it has lots of pictures, which will help.
Matthew, oh, okay, a picture book. Wonderful. That is really what I need after working on all these RPGs. Because you know what the worst thing about editing role playing games is, y'all? The worst thing. I have to deal with all the text before it has art.
Right.
And so when you, our lovely listeners, get the books, it's divided up into these beautiful, you know, little boxes and tables, and there's beautiful art every few pages, and the book itself is usually very pretty. And I'm just looking at Word files that occasionally say, you know, sidebar.
Yeah. And actually, like, that's something that it's actually a kind of a problem. I won't digress too much about this, but there's been more than one time where I've had to work with licensors or external partners, and I'll give them a manuscript to review or comment on, and I'll get some kind of comments of, okay, it's a little hard to understand, hopefully you can kind of clarify future. I'll go, okay, cool, make almost no changes to it, put it in layout, and they go, yeah, this is much easier to read, because the layout process is actually part of how we absorb information.
Yeah, exactly. Because I mean, yeah, we're trying to make it easier to read and easier to absorb. And when you're just looking at a table in a Word file where it's just separated by tabs, and I'm trying to figure out which things go in which columns because they're all kind of offset from each other because some words are longer than others. And then I'm like, I think I edited this correctly. And you finally see it in the book and you're like, oh, this table is lovely and actually very useful.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, on going back to Chicago briefly, in the city chapter, there's a lot of tables for basically randomly generating events and mishaps and the like that can occur through your city. And this was one of Mike Tomasek's creations. And as a standard, here's an inner peek to the process, I guess. The way we lay out tables is, as Dixie describes, we just tab between the different columns and then enter, and then we're on another row, but we can't actually put in a Microsoft Word table or anything like that because it screws up the layout process.
Mm-hmm.
However, on the previewed version that we've got on the Kickstarter, we do have a Microsoft Word table, because I thought when I first tried laying it out in the proper way, I thought no one is going to be able to understand this because the text is all over the damn place. So if we give this to Kickstarter backers, they're going to look at it and think, what the hell are they writing?
Yeah.
So I've got a note on my desktop that is, once the Kickstarter ends, edit that. And then send it off to editing.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things, this isn't one of our lines, but one of my favorite things to edit in text versus seeing it in print are Fantasy Flight properties, because they have their special dice symbols that are scattered all throughout the text. And when you see them in Word, it's just some combination of letters in little brackets. And I'm constantly having to check it and be like, is that the right die symbol? I think so.
Right.
Because without seeing the actual symbols, it's hard to tell. You know, it doesn't look like anything. It just, yeah. But yeah, so that's a fun little peek behind the curtain for what it looks like when we're working on it versus what it looks like when you see the PDF or get it in your hands. So on that note, because we're actually going a little longer than I thought we were, Eddie, where can people find you if they want to do so?
You can find me just about anywhere at Eddie Fate, EddyFate. You can find me on my website, eddyfate.com, or professionally, you can find me at Pugsteady or Pugsteady.com.
Awesome. And Matthew?
You can find me on Twitter as ClackClickBang. You can find me on the Onyx Path Forum and on YouTube as The Gentleman Gamer. And if you are not already, please subscribe to the Onyx Path YouTube channel. There will be content coming there soon. And look for Onyx Path on Twitch as well. We have some plans coming up.
Exciting! As always, you can find me at Dixie Cyanide. You can find us at theonyxpath.com and all over the place. If you search for The Onyx Path, it's pretty much all us. We have an Instagram account now. That's pretty cool. So we have all kinds of fun ways for you to interact and engage. Yeah. Check out Chicago by Night. And if you are at PAX Unplugged next weekend, come by the booth and say hi, or come play a demo. I know we've got quite a few people running demos all throughout the con. You could play a game with Eddie, maybe. Play a game with Neil.
Pogmire and Mao. Neil's running sound, I believe. So, yeah.
And also, there's a lot of people that will run stuff at request. Like, we might have an Exalted Lunars playtest there. I don't know. Let's just find out. Come ask us. Only way to find out. So Eddie and I will be there along with quite a lot of other Onyx Path folks. So definitely come say hello. Thank you so much. As always, Mini Worlds, One Path Cast. Did we lose Eddie or did we lose me? All right, so we seem to have lost Eddie into some kind of void, possibly beneath the sea. We're not sure.
Wait, Matthew, no, here I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, what?
Oh, God. Gave me a heart
You're
attack.
Back.
I stuck up from beneath the sea.
Okay, so let's try this one more time.